Thanks, Elaine. And yeah, welcome again to the Intimacy Deficit, particularly if you're with us for the first time. Great to see you. And in particular, good to keep on making the point that I've stressed a number of times this week, that when we think about intimacy, we are not talking about sex. We're talking about a much wider, deeper, richer definition of what intimacy is. Wholeness through connection is what we've been talking about this week. And we've hopefully been discovering that that sort of wholeness through connection, that sort of intimacy can be found in a whole range of different contexts. The ones that we've been focusing on this week are here in this intimacy quadrant. The God who created you has created you to need connection, to need a sense of oneness, union with God, with yourself, with others, and with creation. Today we're thinking about connection with others, but over the last two days at the beginning of this week, we looked at intimacy with God and yourself. And I've been saying all the way through that these contexts for intimacy aren't sequential. You don't get intimacy with God sorted, and then you move on to intimacy with yourself, and then you move on. I know that's how we've been doing it this week, inevitably, but hopefully you're going to be seeing increasingly how they feed off each other and how wonderfully one contributes the other. So just to take the first two, I hope just hearing of God's love for you, hearing that he's your father, your friend, your fiancé, has helped you feel better about yourself and has contributed to your intimacy with yourself. And then as we thought about intimacy with yourself, as we thought about whose we are and who we are, the fact that we're God's children, the fact that God has uniquely created and gifted each of us in this room, has increased your intimacy with God too. Those two feed off each other, don't they, really nicely? And hopefully as we go on, you'll see how the others really contribute to each other too. But today, intimacy with others. And this is what we advertised would be happening this morning. Always good to remind myself of what we're supposed to be doing. Filling the intimacy deficit by enjoying others. To be satisfied in life, we need to feel connected, united to others. Why don't we? How can we better enjoy deep relationships with others? Why are time and vulnerability such powerful relationship catalysts? Hopefully we're going to answer those questions, find out useful things in answer to them this morning. And just before we start, I really want to sort of, again, just state, sort of push against the culture. Because obviously in many contexts, when we're talking about intimacy and an intimacy deficit, in many contexts, people would presume that this session would be called the intimacy deficit, or filling the intimacy deficit by enjoying another, by enjoying one other person. That is what we're told to expect in life, that we will find someone who will meet all our intimacy needs and we'll walk off into the sunset together and live happily ever after. I noticed just a little bit of laughter in the room and that some of you have discovered that that is not true. And I just want to spend a bit of time bashing the idea and what I would call here the fruitless search for your other half. We have this phrase in our culture, don't we, of have you met your other half? Have you met my other half? We use that sort of phrase a number of times. And at one level, it's a harmless phrase. You're basically saying, have you met my husband or wife? Have you met? And at one level, I don't want to sort of become sort of some sort of thought police and ban the saying, the other half. But let's be honest, at another level, I do. I actually want people to be arrested for using it. Because I think it's a really unhelpful phrase to talk about your other half, my other half. Why? Well, just think of the effect that it has on single people. When we're using the phrase, you know, have you met your other half? Have you met my other half? It makes us single people feel as if we're sort of slightly incomplete until the day when we meet our other half. And we're sort of walking around sort of really lopsided all the time because we haven't yet found the one person who's going to complete us. And I think it's just a really dangerous thing think a lot of single people feel incomplete often, are made to feel incomplete by society around us, and use of the phrase, your other half, reinforces that. But I also think it's really dangerous for the married people in this room, because I think what often is communicated by this idea that your half and somebody else's half, and when you come together in marriage, you're complete, is that it means that married couples feel that they should be relationally sorted by having married this other person. They feel that they should have no more intimacy needs that this other person shouldn't meet. And they become quite bitterly disappointed quite quickly. Because actually, it turns out we haven't been designed to be satisfied, to have all our intimacy needs met by just one other person. And I found in my pastoral ministry, again and again and again, that actually some of the loneliest people are people who have got married and who have been fed the lie that this one other person is going to meet all their needs. And if so, as a result, that is why I'm up for people being arrested for using the phrase, your other half. Somebody who reflects well on this and the implications of this is the British-born, American-working journalist Andrew Sullivan. He writes this. Families and marriages fail too often because they're trying to answer too many human needs. A spouse is required to be a lover, a friend, a mother, a father, a soulmate, a co-worker, and so on. Few people can be all these things for one person. And when demands are set too high, disappointment can only follow. If husbands and wives have deeper and stronger friendships outside the marital unit, the marriage has more space to breathe and fewer burdens to bear. That's so important for us to hear. That's important for us to hear if we are married. You need other close connections with other people. You cannot get everything you need for your husband and wife, which means that you need other married friends in your life. You also need other single friends in your life. And this is really good news for single people as well. Your married friends need you. They desperately need you. They need you to support their marriage. They need you to be their friends. They need you to talk about how difficult married family life is so often. Really important that we all recognize, whether we're single or married in this room, that we need other people, and that God's answer to loneliness is not marriage. I think there's a big competition for the most badly applied verse in the whole of Scripture, but I think in the top 10 would be Genesis, 2 verse 18, where it talks about, where God said it's not good for man to be alone, and so often that is applied to, right, therefore you need to find a husband or a wife. If you see what God does next, he creates Eve, and so in some ways there's a justification for marriage being part of the answer to loneliness. But of course, out of that marriage of the first man and first woman come family and community and friendship and all the other possible contexts for human intimacy needs to be met. And it's really important that we see that God's answer to loneliness is much wider than find one other person and get married to them. That's that rant over, okay? Have I made a point? I hope so. Apologies if I've offended. Let's just think about the importance of this, not just in the context we just talked about, but also pastorally. The importance of recognizing how our intimacy needs are met, not just in one relationship, but in multiple relationships pastorally. I found as a pastor for 25 years, very long gap year, that most pastoral needs are to a large extent explained by people's lack of friendships, by people's lack of connection, deep connections with other people. I wish I could say I was emotionally intelligent enough to alert this myself, but I'm not. Thankfully, I have a friend called Joelsner, and over the years, I sort of ministered alongside, served alongside, had Joelsner as my friend. One of the things she's consistently got me asking when somebody's life is in a muddle or a mess is, who are their friends? I now call this the Joelsner question, much to her embarrassment. But it's been such a helpful question to ask. Somebody's struggling in our small group. Somebody's really struggling in their marriage. somebody's really struggling in a whole host of different contexts, one of the key questions to ask is, who are their friends? And one of the sort of tragic things when you ask this question is that you so often find that the answer to the question is a bit of a long silence. And the reason why they're so struggling to get settled in your church family, or the reason they're struggling in their marriage, or the reason for whatever's going on, one of the deep reasons is they just don't have friends. And actually the problem has been a lack of friendship. The presenting issue is the thing that sort of brought them to your attention. The solution is some friends. And as a result of this, one of the ways in which I'm always wanting to train up people in Christian ministry is to say Christian ministry, particularly local church Christian ministry, is about being friendship catalysts. Actually just encouraging people, creating context in which people can build friendships. Small groups, obviously one way of that happening. Getting on teams to serve at church together. Coming away on the Keswick Convention. I think I mentioned yesterday how much I enjoyed going on summer camps, leading summer camps for kids in my 20s. Out of that came a whole host of friendships, which I'm deeply grateful for. So who are their friends? Such a key question to be asking, and perhaps quite a personal question for us to ask ourselves this morning. Is one of the reasons you have an intimacy deficit in your life, because to be honest, your answer to that question, who are my friends, is, I'm not quite sure. Well, if that's you, you're in the right place this morning. And let's explore what intimacy with others, friendship, looks like. And as ever, we're going to start with the biblical bookends. We're going to start by looking back and seeing what things were like when everything was perfect, and we can look forward to what things will be like when everything's perfect again. And let's turn to the first biblical bookend, and I'm going to need to explain this quite carefully. Okay, Adam and Eve, his wife, were both naked and they felt no shame. Let me be clear, intimacy with others is not standing with them naked, okay? That's not what I'm suggesting from this. What I want to say, though, is intimacy with others is not hiding yourself from them. It's being open about what you're thinking and what you're feeling. It's saying, this is what I need. This is how you hurt me. This is what I'm really struggling with in life. I really found it difficult when you... The sort of idea of just in some ways being emotionally sort of raw and open with people, being seen by people, is what we're talking about here. And intimacy with others is something that we're going to enjoy long term. That's why I like the other biblical bookend in Revelation 21. If you think that eternity is just going to be you and Jesus talking to each other for a long time, just one-to-one, you're going to be disappointed. You know, it's a community project, this thing we're all involved in. And this is how it's explained. This is how it's advertised in Revelation 21. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will be with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be them and be their God. We will get to hang out with God in the new creation, but the good news is we'll get to hang out with each other too. I mean, just look around you. That's going to be fun, isn't it? Okay? Get to hang out with other people too. Enjoy intimacy with God and others in the new creation, and we will be there for eternity. Okay, we're not there yet. Perfection is not here yet. So let's ask this question. What stops you from enjoying intimacy with others? Perhaps you're sitting there thinking, yeah, my answer to the Joel's the question is, I don't have many friends. I do feel a particular intimacy deficit in this area. I have relied too much on my husband or wife to meet my intimacy needs, or I have thought too much that if only I was married, I would have no intimacy needs. Let's think through what is stopping us from enjoying deep connections, deep sense of oneness, openness with other people. What are the human blockers, if I can put it like that, in play? Well, of course, there are loads. But let me just share some of the things that I've seen at play in my life and in the lives of others I know and love too. Here are some blockers to intimacy with others. I think the first one is probably just fear, and it's worth naming it. We fear what it will be like being open with other people. We fear that if we tell them that about ourselves, they'll walk away. We fear that we never have been one of the popular kids, and that we're going to experience rejection yet again. And let's be honest, for some of us, the fears are justified. We have opened ourselves up to other people in the past, and we told them something really big, and then they started talking about the weather quite quickly. And that sort of made us afraid. It's justified in our own minds, in our own hearts, our fears. But a lot of us just live in fear of just speaking out the truth, and the fear is just such a negative thing, and there's no reason for it. I mean, the example for my life would be me getting the guts to tell friends about my questions and struggles around my sexuality. I think probably about the sort of 20th or 30th friend I told, about halfway through telling them about my experiences of sex attraction, I noticed that I wasn't trembling. I said, "Oh, look, I'm not trembling." And they went, "You know, what are you talking about?" But it just illustrated I had become so afraid. And actually, as I started talking to friends, I think one out of 30 started talking about the weather. But the vast majority of them were interested and responded with love and grace. But I was so afraid. And I think one of the things we can perhaps may helpfully do this morning is just name our fear of rejection. Perhaps justified, perhaps unjustified. That's what sometimes stops genuine connection taking place. Closely allied with fear is pride. So let's be honest, one of the reasons I was fearful about telling people about my experience of same-sex attraction was because I quite liked the image I think I'd managed to build up of being quite a sorted Christian. And I was going to tell them something that would show that I really was not a sorted Christian. And it was my pride that was stopping me from being open and honest and establishing a deeper connection with others through sharing what was going on in my heart and mind. I think our culture sort of bigs up, doesn't it, the idea of us being independent people. And we think that success is managing without other people sometimes. And we've got to recognize that pride is part of the cancer that stops us from actually saying, this is what's really going on. This is how life's worked out. Particularly sometimes, and Jason gave an example of this last night in the evening celebration, particularly when we're going back after a number of years and saying, look, that problem I talked to you about 10, 15 years ago, actually it's still a problem and it's got worse. You know, we like testimonies, don't we, that are getting better. And to go back to somebody and say, actually, yeah, that thing I told you about 10, 15 years ago has actually got worse. That's not good for our pride, so we avoid it. Masculinity is a problem. Men in this room, we want to be careful about investing in gender stereotypes, but let's recognize that there is, particularly among men, a sort of rugged individualism that is sometimes portrayed and encouraged, and to our shame, particularly sometimes portrayed and encouraged in Christian communities, that isolates men and makes us think that to be a too godly man, we have to be independent of others and, you know, have no emotions and never struggle. That's not biblical Christianity, but it is out there a lot. And I find that a lot of men are, even within our churches, really isolated and have bought into what I think is a toxic vision of masculinity, which is real men cope alone. They don't. I mean, let's think of the great example of masculinity in the Bible, Jesus. And he had a whole host of friends. He was at the center of a network of relationships. He had friends who were closer. He had male and female friends. He is not an example of rugged individualism. He's an example of living life in a community dependent on others. So if you want to be a real man, Jesus is the real man, and notice how he does friendship, how he does intimacy. Romanticism is also a bit of a blocker. I'm going to do something which is sort of very rare. I may not have ever done this in public before, so it's quite a moment. I'm going to criticise C.S. Lewis. I'm sorry to... I know... the trapdoor has not opened up. C.S. Lewis, in his lovely book, The Four Loves, just talks about friendship in a sort of in a slightly romantic way of you sitting down and suddenly discovering that somebody else has got the same interest in sort of steam engines as you, and you sort of look them in the eyes and you discover this person who, you know, is going to be your best friend forever because of your shared love in steam engines. I don't think he uses a steam engine analogy. But he makes it sound quite romantic. You just click and just, it's wonderful. Now, sometimes that's what happens, isn't it, in friendship? Your shared love of steam engines, you know, has built a beautiful friendship of intimacy that, you know, far surpasses any other relationship on this planet. I doubt it, but perhaps. But I do think we sometimes just need to find somebody where it clicks, and to think that's how friendship works. I don't think that's how friendship works. You know, actually, some of the people I have clicked with on an interest level are some of the friends that, you know, it's really lovely to sit down and talk about American 20th century literature with. But actually, the real friends I need are those I haven't clicked with, but have just been good friends because we've lived life together for a long time and they've been there. So I just want to sort of name romanticism as a bit of a problem. I also want to name perfectionism as a particular problem for me, and might be for other people in this room. There's a massive danger of demanding of our friends perfectionism, and as soon as they fail us, thinking and walking away. And, you know, I don't know what you're like on that, but I think I've got a pretty bad track record sometimes of just doing that, of somebody lets me down or disagrees with me, you know, bearish the thought, and, you know, I just sort of withdraw a bit. Perfectionism, massive blocker intimacy with others. And then two others which I want to mention. One is moving. What I mean is, I think in today's culture, particularly, and I want to sort of recognise that this is perhaps particularly true in middle-class professional cultures, not all cultures in the UK today, but people move around a lot, and it destroys friendships. You know, I've noticed working with people in their 20s, as I have, you know, ever since I was in my 20s myself, is how much they're moving around and how destructive that is of friendship. People go to university in one place, they do a postgrad MA in another, then a doctorate somewhere else, and then they're on an internship, and on one level that's pretty inevitable because that's just how life happens now, but it is destructive of friendships. And actually moving around can sometimes mean that just when friendships get going, just when they get to deeper level, just when real connections are being made, off you go somewhere else. And obviously things like Zoom and text help us do friendships in different areas, different places. But what I'm always wanting to say to people in the UK, as much as possible, recognising all the sort of but what abouts, is if you can stay somewhere as long as you possibly can. And that might mean sacrificing the promotion. It might mean actually doing a degree program that's not quite as exciting as. It might mean, you know, your children not getting into the best school in your area. But if you've got good friends and you're enjoying intimacy with others, be very loath to move, because what you've got is very precious. And it will take a long time to really rebuild elsewhere. You know, one of the God's many gracious acts to me has been to sort of root me in Bristol since 2001, because it means I have friends, you know, who we've just got layers of archaeology, and that's a very beautiful, precious thing. So if you can avoid moving, I know it's not always possible, but if you can, do. And then busyness is the other block to intimacy with others. And if I was to say, you know, what is the particular problem for me, and friends of mine who are out there would probably nod, I'm not going to look actually, would probably nod at this point. I try and do too much, and I try and treat loneliness with busyness. And it's in some ways quite effective. You know, if you keep yourself busy, You can meet the intimacy need through busyness quite a lot of the time until you have to stop, because we do have to stop, you know, and you're ill or it's an evening off or a day off and actually you're there going, oh, you know, I feel alone. It's because, well, you know, nobody's actually heard from you for about the last 2 months because you've been so busy. And I think we need to recognize, particularly some of us who are the more activist types, that busyness is something that's very destructive of human connection, particularly deep human connection. If every time somebody asks you a question, how are you, you're too busy to answer, you have got, like me, a bit of a problem. So these are some of the blockers to intimacy with others I've seen play in my own life and in the lives of others too. Should we try and be a bit more positive? And think about practically how we can enjoy intimacy with others. If that's the problem, if that's the intimacy deficit, we're here to try and fill it. How can we enjoy intimacy with others? And three things I think are key. Intentionality, vulnerability, diversity. So intentionality is basically planning. Friendships need to be planned. I mean, that's not a book title, is it? But they do. We need to be intentional about friendships. Vulnerability, friendships come out of conversations in which people share that sort of the deepest, the hardest things in their lives. And good friendships, I think, really reflect the diversity of the human race in all the diversity markers there are, because difference is really important. You know, at one level, I want my friends to be like me, but at another level, there would be nothing more damaging than if I had a lot of friends who were just like me. We need friends who are diverse, who are different to us. So let's talk about learning intentionality in friendships, learning to actually really make sure that friendships happen. And I'm going to use an illustration here, which I'm not really qualified to use, because I'm going to talk about gardening. I don't have a garden. I did try and earn some money as a gardener, as a teenager. People didn't seem to have me back for some reason. So I'm not an expert. But I know that if you have a garden, it needs constant work. It takes pruning and planting and watering and time and care. That's my knowledge of gardening. That's what friendships need too, all those things. And you need to be intentional. You need to give time and care to friendships if you're to fill your intimacy deficit. And these are some of the things you need to plan, think about doing. You need to share life. You need to deliberately be thinking, how can I share my life with other people? How can I share meals with other people? How can I share holidays with other people? How can I share jobs around the home with other people? How can we share jobs at church with other people? In some ways, whatever I'm doing, how can I do it with someone else? So that actually you give yourself the chances to share your life and get to know people and spend time with people. All those things are things you're probably going to be doing already. You know, meals, shopping. I mean, it's not sort of adding new things to your diary. It's just saying some of these things we do in life and we often do alone, do them with other people. So, you know, for me, one of my friendships is based around, we've been watching box sets together for I don't know how many years. I would be watching those box sets anyway. I'd be having a meal before them anyway. It's been a delight to, over a number of years, meet up and have a meal and watch a box set with a friend. Gives us a chance to hang out, to spend time with each other, to fill our intimacy deficit. Both of us would be doing those sort of things already. Why not do it with somebody else? But that takes planning. And it means developing habits, which I think is key to this. So this friend and some other friends, we developed the habit of, at the beginning of every term, we put in dates to see each other for the rest of the term. Now this is, you know, solving an Edshaw problem, but I know that unless at the beginning of the term, unless I put dates in the diary to spend time with my friends, what will happen about 2 weeks into the term is that all those slots would have gone with meetings and various things I'm doing. So they need to be in the diary at the beginning of the term so that they're protected and so that they happen. And, you know, just to prove that, I do this with a couple I'm good friends with and another single person I'm good friends with. And myself and the single person, we got the dates in the diary for this term, so they've happened. Couple, for various reasons, we didn't get the dates in the diary and they haven't happened. And it's just a reminder that that little habit, it's just a small little habit, has been really helpful. Or, you know, with other people I meet up with regularly, the other habit we've developed, the trick we've developed is when I'm around at their home, we then get the next date in the diary. Because otherwise, what tends to happen is you have a lovely evening with some friends, and we must do it again as you walk out the door. And about 2 months afterwards, we must do it again. And then it takes about 2 months to find a date. And then the date is 2 months after that. And you haven't seen them for 6 months. And they're really good friends. So why not just get, what are the little habits you could develop that make sure that you actually do spend time enriching, developing, deepening friendships that you have or friendships that you think you could have with that friend of church, with those friends from whatever context. So share life, just the ordinary things of life. And develop habits. And for me, other habits that have been really helpful have been just an annual holiday with a group of friends, which we've been doing for, turns out, 20 years. Because one of the children was 6 months and is now 20. So even I can do the maths. Or, Keswick, I'll be back at Keswick week 3. I've just got into the habit of doing that with a group of friends. And it's just a habit that keeps the friendship going. Two friends of mine in London, we just see each other every month. I got into the habit of whenever I'm going anywhere near London, I'll get in contact and say, shall we meet up for a meal? So share life and develop habits. Don't think it's just going to happen. Gardens don't just look after themselves. Friendship circles need a lot of work, time, care, attention, pruning. The other thing to do is to spot changes. Life changes, isn't it? We go through different stages of life. And just recognizing that that will have an impact on our friendships. So I talked about with Elaine earlier, you know, my 20s in Bristol were a time of great friendships, of being able to spend a lot of time with each other. There was a group of us that served on the student team at our church, and we did a lot of things together. We were serving the students of our church together, but we also went on holidays together. We served on summer camps together. We did a huge amount of things together. A lot of entertaining happened, and it was just really easy. Then people got married, and that affected things a little bit, but not as much as when people started having kids, which changed things massively. And we probably, and spotting that change and thinking about that change was something that some of us were able to do, and some friendships, kept going. Others just didn't because of that. And it's just worth recognizing, what are the changes coming up? How are they going to impact things? If we really value this friendship, how are we going to stop that from happening? We're now, that group of friends, we're now moving into sort of our mid-late 40s. And things are changing again because... And those children that came along and exploded our friendships are now leaving home. And actually, we're moving to a whole new stage of life, and we need to be talking about what friendships will look in that new stage of life. Just spot the changes. Another thing would be, I planted a church in 2014, and I'd just written this book called The Plausibility Problem, and one of the chapters was about my church family life, and so many people would come up to me in 2014, 15 and say, I love what you say about your church family life. It's just so beautiful. Those pictures of the people you managed to spend time with, and it was true, it was beautiful, but I just planted a church, and that meant that those friendships had to change, and I was no longer able to see, particularly the two sort of families I spent a lot of time with. It was an inevitable change, sad change, but we should have, it talked about it and explored it more. We just need to spot changes and sort of plan how friendships can flourish, work in different ways when things change. Really important for us to spot changes. We also need to make lists. Now, this is the opposite end of the extreme from sort of romanticism. This is going to sound a bit weird, but I think a lot of us need to make lists of our friends and just begin to categorize them a bit. Who are the friends who really are my best friends? Who are the friends I really need to be seeing on a weekly basis? Who are the friends that I really like, but to be honest, we had a great time at university. I'm not going to see them for a while, and we just need to arrange to meet up early on in the new creation. You know, or something like that. You know, just in some ways, just sit down and categorize a bit. What I'm not saying is that you then sort of write to people and say, and I've just been sitting down and I've culled my friendship list, and the bad or good news, depending on your point of view, is you haven't made the cut. But I do think there's probably some benefit in just sort of thinking for a little bit strategically sometimes. And I'm going to illustrate that with a diagram, excitement, in just a few moments' time. And then the other thing I think I just want us all to do is just to pray hard. You know, some of us were sitting there thinking, this sounds great, Ed, but I just don't have any friends. I mean, you know, actually, me talking about making a list is just a really painful thing. You're not sure who you put on the list. You don't feel you have any friends. You have just moved. You are very busy. You're single. This just feels... Pray hard. And get other people to be praying hard that God would, in his grace, provide you with the friends that you need. And pray that he'd help you see what you could do proactively to do that, but also what you're going to need him to do miraculously to give you the friendships that you do need to thrive as a human being. Now, this next slide, I'm embarrassingly proud of. You'll look at it and think, it's very bad, and you won't be able to read it. But apart from that, it's really good. So learning intentionality and friendships. Hopefully you can see a series of circles. At the center of that circle is you or me. And what I wanted just to encourage us is to think of our friendships in those sort of concentric outward circles. And what I think we need to do is just try and make sure that you have friends in different sort of rings of the circles. So I think we all need, you know, two or three close friends who we're in sort of daily, weekly contact with. We need other friends who, you know, perhaps more monthly contact with. Other friends who are a little bit sort of, you know, who perhaps we're at university with and we catch up with once a year. But we need people in these different bands if our intimacy needs are to be met. And, you know, some of us, for instance, we actually have one or two really close friends. And actually, we perhaps need to sort of broaden out our friendship groups and have others, particularly for wanting more diverse friends. Others of us will actually think, I've got loads of people who I see once a month or once a year, but I've actually got very few people who know what's going on in my life on a sort of daily, weekly basis. So therefore, we need to invest in that sort of that inner circle, if I can put it like that. And Phil Knox, who's written a great book on friendship, he works at the Evangelical Alliance, sort of is behind this diagram, and he manages to do it much better in his book. But one of the things he points out is that, of course, Jesus did friendship quite like this. You know, we know, don't we, from the Gospels that Jesus had two or three of the disciples who seemed to have been his particular inner friendship group, had the wider group of 12 disciples. He had a whole host of other people that were his disciples that traveled around with him. And I think one of the things we perhaps need to do is we're thinking intentionally about friendship, is think, have I got the right spread of friendships? Of course, people will move in and out of circles when perhaps you move or they move. All life circumstances change, and that's fine. But I know that, you know, just every so often I need to come back to a diagram like this and make sure that there are people that are seeing me on a weekly basis, daily basis, rather than just a monthly basis, just to help me and to help them. I'm sure this will be producing questions. Hopefully we'll have some time for some questions, but only if I speed up. So let's move on to learning vulnerability in friendships. I think vulnerability can sort of happen if we just do two very simple things. We ask questions and we share intimacies. And we ask good questions. How are you is not a good question, really. I mean, very rarely does the question, how are you, give you the information you need to be a good friend. Unless you do that sort of, you know, how are you, and then they don't answer you, no, how are you really? You know, with a sort of pastoral look, where you might actually get a little bit further. But just, I think the best way of thinking, what are the questions you want to be asked? What are the questions you long somebody to ask you? And ask those questions. It's interesting that when I was in my 20s, I longed for somebody to ask me why I was single. because I resolved myself I would tell them if somebody asked. But, you know, for good reasons nobody did, because it's quite, you know, it feels like quite an intrusive question, doesn't it? But really asking God, what are the questions you would like to be asked? One of the dangers we can fall into is waiting for other people to be good friends to us, rather than thinking the best way of getting good friends is being a good friend to other people. What are the questions I would like to be asked that would really get the truth about what's going on? Ask those questions of other people. And then just share intimacies. Turns out that the beautiful answer to our intimacy deficit is sharing intimacies with others, that we create intimacy by sharing intimacies. You share something deeply painful and hard with someone else, and that creates intimacy, particularly when they respond in kind. Perhaps saying, yeah, that's a real issue for me too. Or perhaps saying, actually, that's not an issue for me, but I felt similar feelings in this very different area of life. Intimacy breeds intimacy. Share something deep and painful. Not always, but I found often people respond in kind and the friendship moves to a whole new level. And it's a beautiful moment. David Brooks is a commentator over in the States. Interestingly, recently become a Christian. And so many of his books sort of don't make that explicit, but very implicit in what he writes. And he says, intimacy happens when somebody shares something emotionally meaningful and the other person receives it and shares it back. And I don't know you, but I found that again and again. I can't promise you it will always happen, but by and large, I found that breaking through to deeper levels in friendship comes through sharing deep things in a friendship. And that's really, really important. And of course, the market leader on this is Jesus. That's what he did with his friends. We've been already in this verse this week. But John 15, verse 15. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything I have learned from my Father, I have made known to you. Jesus was vulnerable with his disciples. Jesus shared with his disciples. Jesus built deep, intimate relationship with the disciples as a result. Intimacy others also comes through learning diversity, intentionality, vulnerability, and then also diversity. I think it's really important for us to have friendships with people from different backgrounds, particularly within the church, which is God's great reunification project for humanity, reconciliation project for humanity. We of all people should be demonstrating that we don't just hang out with people like us, with the same amount of money in the bank account, same job, same background, same skin color, same whatever. We should be demonstrating diversity in our friendships and enjoying the diversity that comes through friendship. You know, some of my friendships would have been some of my friends I would have been paired with if it had all gone into a computer algorithm. But actually what I most appreciate about most of my friends is that we wouldn't have been matched as friends. They're just very different to me. They've got very different interests. One friend, we could never go on holiday together because it would be a disaster. But we can still be really good friends. And different backgrounds, different experiences, different personalities, really important in friendships, perhaps particularly Christian friendship. And then I think, and this is where we're going to stray if we haven't already, into a little bit of controversy, I do think we need to be having both same-sex friendships and opposite-sex friendships. Usually in Christian communities, same-sex friendships massively encourage opposite-sex friendships, unless you're about to propose, deeply frowned upon. And there's, been good reasons for that, but I think it means that a lot of us have become a bit too limited in where we go looking for friendships in a way that damages us and other people. And we'll come back in a second to the different vision that the New Testament gives us when it comes to friendship. But can I just, before we do that, talk about intergenerational friendships? Some of my the friendships that I have most valued are with people who are old enough to be my parents. Really valued friendships of people who are old enough to be my parents, who are the same age as my parents. Also increasingly valuing friendships with people who are young enough to be my kids. And learning the perspective, the insight, the strengths of a younger generation, really appreciating as I move into middle age, or you know, get very comfortable in middle age, the whole benefit of having intergenerational friendships, people older and younger than me. That really helps the diversity in friendship. And I think a biblical encouragement to same-sex friendships, to opposite-sex friendships, and to intergenerational friendships comes in the pastoral epistles. Paul writing to Timothy, a young pastor, and encouraging him to be at the heart of a whole network of relationships and to do ministry with people older than him and younger than him, people who are male like him and women in the church too. And I just want us to see that 1 Timothy chapter 5 reads quite differently to what a lot of us have often heard. So I'm going to read the version we've heard and then the real version. So the word version I think we've often heard is, do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were a father. Treat younger men as brothers. Do not speak to women alone unless anybody gets the wrong idea. That's the version of this that we've often heard. That's not the advice that Paul gives Timothy. Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he was your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. Paul is saying to Timothy, you know, just basically treat your church family as a family. Treat the men and women in your church family as a family. Do not be scared of the opposite sex. Do interact with the opposite sex with absolute purity. But you can have friendships. You can be talking to women if you're a man. Men if you're a woman. There's no ban on that. Yes, there's something called the Billy Graham rule, that Billy Graham, because of the particular circumstances of his ministry, had, which was that he wouldn't be alone with another woman, apart from his wife. But that's sort of permeated, I think, far too many relationships. And we need to just, I think, follow the biblical advice here and have intergenerational friendships and friendships that go in a number of directions. So intimacy with other catalysts, intentionality, vulnerability, and diversity. This sort of gardening, this sort of friendship building is going to be quite hard work, isn't it? So let's close with, before we have questions, a couple of encouragements. First of all, why is enjoying intimacy with others so important? Well, that's the question. The first one is this. It's basically just, if you want to be happy, you need to have a whole series of connections with other people. So this is a bit of a social research, Robert Putnam. The single most common finding from half a century of research on the correlates of life satisfaction, not only in the United States but around the world, is that happiness is best predicted by the breadth and depth of one's social connections. Want to be happy in life? Have loads of friends. Enjoy intimacy with others. But also, and this is particularly relevant for church communities, I think, is if we want our church communities to be safe places, we need to build friendships and we need to encourage friendships, particularly in our leaders. Because there have been a number of leadership scandals in the UK, US church and further afield in recent years. And I don't know about you, I spent a lot of time trying to think through why. And one of the most convincing answers I found is this quote from Henry Nouwen. He says this, "One thing is clear to me, the temptation of power is greatest when intimacy is a threat. Much Christian leadership is exercised by people who do not know how to develop healthy, intimate relationships and have opted for power and control instead. Many Christian empire builders have been people unable to give and receive love." That is tragically true. And so one of the questions I'm wanting to ask of leaders, you know, when people have sort of been applying for leadership positions in my church is, who are your friends? Who are your friends? And what's the evidence that you enjoy deep, intimate relationships with them? Good, deep, proper Christian intimacy with them. Because otherwise you'll be going looking for it in inappropriate and damaging ways, which sadly a lot of people in my position have over the past. That's another reason why this matters so much. Right, these are questions to ponder. I think probably you probably just need to write these down in about 30 seconds, and then we'll go straight into question time. Okay, I've run away with myself a little bit enthusiastically today, but we have got a chance to just probably about 3 or 4 questions. Write these questions down. You can ponder them as you leave. But now, if there are any questions, raise your hand and somebody will come with a microphone and I will do my best.
Sure. Now, Ed, I think you've been a bit optimistic about 3 or 4 questions. I think we've probably got room for 1 or 2, actually. So I am going to go to the person in the third row back, because she was the first person to get her hand in the air. That she was so quick. It's amazing.
Thank you. So I just wanted to ask, I like your diagram, but I have a feeling that we've mostly talked about our Christian friendships. And I know that for me, it's kind of tempting for me to just stay with my Christian friends. It's comfortable. But where is our, like in that diagram, our non-Christian friends?
Yeah.
And not only in the sense like, oh, we have to be a testimony to them and like have this vision, but how can we also develop true and friendship with non-Christians as well?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that question. That's a really helpful way for me to clarify. The diversity of friendship could be spun, you know, also means Christian and non-Christians. And it's really important. And actually, we will, you know, we will thrive in life and help others thrive in life if in all our friendships there's a real mix of Christians and non-Christians. And that's part of the diversity we're looking for. Yeah, thank you.
And you asked the question that somebody else was going to ask as well. So that's good.
And you gave you mentioned at the beginning friendship catalysts. I'm curious to know, if someone was to visit your church, how would it look? How would those friendship catalysts look?
Well, I think it's as simple as that, oh, you must meet. You know, that's the sort of thing. So after church on a Sunday, you'll be talking to somebody, you think, oh, you must meet. And sometimes it's because they're similar life circumstances. Sometimes it's because I just know that this person's really good at looking out for that sort of person. So I think that's the phrase, you must meet. And also having people around and, you know, deliberately having, you know, and we're very good in Christian communities. We have people around for meals to match them up romantically. I mean, you can do that, but not to. But actually, matching people up friendship-wise, you have people around for a meal because you think these people would be great friends. Those are the sort of things it looks like. Thank you.
Quick question over at that side with Bob's microphone.
Danny wants to know, as a child, how can he be a good friend? Does it look any different?
Does it look any different for children? No, I don't think it does. I think, you know, for anybody at any age in this room, you want to be thinking about how you can be a good friend, the intentionality. You want to think about how you can share what you're thinking and feeling, the vulnerability, and you want to be trying to just make as many different friends with many different people as possible. And, you know, making sure that you've got friends from all sorts of different backgrounds. So just the same, thanks for the question.
And the last question, and you were right, Ed, this is our 4th question.
Thank you. How do we make sure that your model for being more intentional planning, your concentric circles, how do we make sure that doesn't move into cliquiness? And also, what about people who might feel like after church, during that coffee session, on the outside of those that concentric circle?
Yeah, really important. And I think, you know, we need to make sure that sort of, when we're sort of thinking about that circle, that we're not thinking selfishly. And actually, you know, some people who we're really good friends with, and, you know, actually, we might be talking to them about it. We actually move them further out, so there's time and space in inner circles, if I can put it like, the language is horrible, but you know what I mean, for some people who are new to the city. So, for instance, in Bristol, this is a major issue for us, particularly in a church park context. We're getting more established, and cliquiness becomes the problem. So you need to think, actually, how do we undermine that? And how do I make sure, as a long-term established member of my church and city, that I have room for new people to come into my friendship group? And again, it's intentionality.
And just as a psychologist rather than a historian, I think it's important to point out, I just had to get that in. I think the other aspect of all of this is that friendship is two-way street. Mm. And when we look at things like diagrammatically like that, it can feel like we're in control. We're not, because it's a two-way street.
And doing that prayerfully as well, because it's a sort of, it can't be a three-way street, but, you know, we need God's help.
It kind of is.
Yeah, it can.
Yeah. That's brilliant. We're out of time, Ed. Thank you so much again. Let's show appreciation. I think the amount of material you managed to cover is just wonderful. Let me pray for us as we go into the rest of our day. Father, we thank you for the gift of friendship. Thank you that you draw us into your community and into the community of the church, but also the community of humanity. And we pray that you would help us to be good friends to others. Help us even today, during this convention, to be strengthening friendships that are already exist, but help us too to be open to new friendships, even today, emerging as we mix with one another. So watch over us and bless us, we pray, in Jesus' name. Amen.